Calling all small firm architects, it's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast, it's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Brian Masana, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
It's great to have you here. We just chatted a little bit before we started recording, and I think we're clicking already. So I'm looking forward to having this conversation and learning a little bit more about you and your firm and the things that you're doing. Let me introduce you. Brian Masana is an architect based in New York City, founded in 1996 by Brian and Toby O'Rourke. Masana O'Rourke is renowned for crafting spaces of sublime restraint and ethereal beauty. Brian trained under architects Richard Meyer, Thomas Pfeiffer, Hani Rashid, Peter Marino, working on projects including the Canal Plus headquarters in Paris, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Barcelona, the Christian Dior Paris flagship, and several others. I'm looking forward to this conversation, Brian. I'm thinking that you and I are very much on the same page in terms of building small firms and focusing on the business and sharing our knowledge with one another and sharing our knowledge with other architects. And so I'm excited about that. But before we get into the conversation about what you do and how you do it, I'd love to know where you came from. What, when did you discover your passion for architecture, and what or who inspired you to get started as a?
I think I was really lucky. I have always wanted to be an architect. My father, who is now 86, had his own design firm, interior design firm, for 40 plus years. So I grew up in it. I was fascinated by, the first thing I remember is going to his office, and I was fascinated by the models, the renderings. For some reason, very into the storage room where all the pencils and erasers were. Yeah. I can still smell, we don't have that kind of smell anymore in offices.
Right. Exactly.
All you hear is like click, 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 click. But I love the desks and sort of the rolling of the T-bars and all that stuff. And it was really fascinating to me. And so I would start to accompany him we're talking like probably nine years old first doing this, and then going to visit sites with him. And then we were very fortunate. He's Italian. He immigrated when he was 16 and put himself through school and went to Pratt and a few other schools. And he eventually had our house built in Los Angeles. And it was just an amazing experience because we would visit it every weekend and yeah. I'd watch the whole process of it being built and, you know, meeting the contractors. And I was just fascinated. So as growing up in the area that I was growing up, there was always some sort of construction going on. So I would always visit the sites. And
was that when you learned about architecture? Because you said your dad had a design firm, interior designer. When did you discover that there was a profession called architecture and what an architect did? Do you remember that moment and what inspired you? Or was it just sort of intuitive through sort of experiencing your everyday life?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. So I think with the house that we grew up in was very architects, because he designed the whole house. So from exterior to interior, and he would build models. And but I knew who like Frank Lloyd Wright was.
Yeah.
We were exposed to, when we were on vacation, I remember going to Death Valley and going to a place called Scotty's Castle, which was this amazing house in the middle of the desert. I also remember being like in awe of going to visit Hearst Castle and discovering Julie Morgan and all the pieces that William Randolph Hearst collected to create this amalgamated architecture for his estate. So I understood the difference between, I said the difference, but I understood both the difference and the similarities between interior and architecture. And I think, actually, now that I'm saying all this, that I feel like that interior exposure and education has made me, obviously has made me what I am in terms of, like, our work in the office here is like 90% these days of interior architecture, just mm-hmm. by being located in New York City.
Right.
But coupled with that background, I really think that our office really is infatuated with both interior space and exterior space, which I think is really important for both architects and interior designers to understand both sides of the coin.
Yeah. And it sounds like because you were introduced to design and the architecture world so early, that it was just always part of your existence. That it was always part of your understanding of the world.
Always. And my father actually should have been sort of a set designer, because he was always still antsy. And so our house is, because that house that I grew up in, and then they later sold it and renovated another house, but it's constantly, I wouldn't say in flux, but it's either an addition mm-hmm. or the change or something. And when I had the good fortune of building my own house, and I remember him coming to it and saying, "Anything new? Have you done anything new?" And I said, "No, it's exactly the same as the day I opened the door and moved in."
Interesting.
Like, I have two younger brothers, and we're all the same. Like, we have like master plans, and once the plan is done, it's
right.
done.
Right. There's you no design more. It to be finished.
Exactly.
And it's finished and it's finished.
Yeah.
And it's like a work of art. It's you finish the work of art and it's,
yeah.
But it sounds like your father reveled and enjoyed the evolution of design.
He's
always improving.
Loved it. Loves it. Still loves it.
Yeah.
Still loves it.
Yeah. Interesting. So interesting to hear your origin story, because a lot of architects come to architecture later. Many of them come to it in childhood, but they can pinpoint that moment. Right. Somebody introduced me to an architect and I learned what architecture was.
Right.
But you were introduced to it so early, because it was part of your everyday existence, that you always knew what it was, and always it was just part of who you were.
Part of who I am. And I don't know if that's, sometimes I think that's a great thing, because I could go straight into and go deeper into what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Sometimes on the flip side, I think to myself, oh, you know, I really wish I would have my bachelor degree instead of architecture was in English so that I could better both verbally and in writing articulate what I am trying to accomplish. Because I would say that if I had a weakness, and I don't know if I have the weakness, but I feel like I have the weakness, is that I'm much more of a doer. And my explanations, I feel, are very simple. And I think our work is probably very similar to that. It's just sometimes I'm trying to find deeper meaning. And the reality is that, we focus on very elemental aspects of I was going to say design, but more about kind of human experience and how someone is going to inhabit one of our projects, and and then there are sort of timeless elements such as light and shadow and space and scale that I find, if properly and thoughtfully understood and executed for every project, it really doesn't matter whether or not you're a modernist or you're a minimalist or you like Baroque architecture. You just apply those basic fundamentals and your work is always going to be beautiful and I think lasting in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that in your work when I looked at it.
Thank you.
It's beautiful and it's beautifully simple. Right. And I want to talk about your process and all of that. But I want to continue the story of how you became an architect. So you it was always part of you, and so where do you go to school and that process?
So and again, I'm an open book, so I will let you know. So always wanted to be an architect. I grew up in Southern California, and at that time, there were three schools to go to in California, because I was California born and raised. I had no thoughts of like going anywhere else. So it was either Berkeley, which in my mind was more conceptual, and there was Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which was more pragmatic. Yeah. And then there was this fledgling little school called SciArc.
Right. Yeah.
And SciArc was in my backyard. For some reason, again, I think it's just part of my personality. And I've tried to think about why, but then I also try to think about like, why is coffee ice cream my favorite flavor? Like I don't drink coffee, but for some reason, that is my go-to ice cream. And, can I dissect it? And I could, I guess, or maybe I can't. So I've come to realize like I am who I am. And I decided I would go to Cal Poly. Now, apparently my grades weren't fully up to the par when I applied coming out of high school. So I went to a little school called UCLA for 2 years where I studied general education. And I was like, oh my God, like this is literally hell for me, because I'm in these auditoriums full of people, students. I'm taking these courses. Like I couldn't understand what this had to do with me and my future. And so I always tell everyone I'm a late bloomer. Like I'm always the last person to the party, et cetera. So this time I decided, okay, I'm going to apply to like a lot of schools. And I did apply to a lot of schools and I got into all of them this time. And I went to Cal Poly and I was immediately like, my life clicked. Like everything like made sense. Like I was doing design classes, history of architecture. Just like, oh yeah, this is me. Yeah. And I was on campus for 2 years and Cal Poly, I want to say, is an amazing school. I'm assuming it still is an amazing school. It was an amazing school when I went there. I mean, the opportunities and the kind of discussions that I remember having with professors, and they're really, really helped inspire me and I think other students to you know, because we're primarily all from California. There was Northern and Southern, and we met in the middle at Cal Poly. And an unusual school because, you know, it's kind of a tech school, but then you're drawing and you look out onto the courtyard and there's literally one time I remember like a cow, a steer, like running through, and then two cowboys like trying to get the steer. And I was like, yeah, we're at Cal Poly, you know? And then there's these crazy kind of artsy element as well. So I spent 2 years there, my second and third year. And then there was they had options. And one of them was to take a summer class or summer school at the École des Beaux-Arts in Fontainebleau. So that was my first time to Europe. And I had been, for some reason, an Anglophile all of my life. I don't know why. I always watched like Sherlock Holmes and, you know, all these English old movies from the 50s and 60s or whatever. And so we touched down in London, and I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And the scale of the streets, the urban fabric, the buildings, I was just like overwhelmed. It was beyond amazing. And we were there for a week. I went with a bunch of students, and then we crossed over into France, into Paris. And I was like, oh my God, this is the first time I've ever not been able to understand the language. Like, I was like, how are we going to get from here to there? So I went to Fontainebleau. I was there at the most amazing time because it was Le Corbusier's centennial. And as a school, which was small, we would get into these buses for 2 weeks, I believe. And I always call it In Search of Corbeau. And we went to all over France. And we stayed at La Tourette. We went to Ronchamp. We went to...
Wow, what an experience.
Everywhere, right? And so my mind kept opening up, right?
Yeah.
I just wanted more and more and more. And I had already organized that after that summer I would go to, we had a consortium program at Virginia Tech's program in Alexandria, where six universities sent about 10 people from each. And again, like here now, I went from Europe to DC, which I had never been to the East Coast. So all of a sudden I go from California, which is stick build, track homes, stucco, you know, at best I'm getting adobe tiled roofs, but now it's like brick architecture. It's like, oh my God, this is crazy. And you could take the subway into DC and see all this amazing art. And it was amazing. So probably like long-winded, but
no, this is what I want to do. I want to understand where you've come from, because it's a fascinating story to have grown up in the family that you've grown up and have that influence, and then go to Cal Poly, then go to Europe, now in DC. You could start putting all the pieces together, right?
Yes.
And when
yes.
you start looking at what you're doing today, it's very clear how that influence,
right,
where those influences came from. It's very
Thank
interesting.
You. Thank you. So I then, from Cal Poly, from Virginia Tech, spent my last year in Florence studying with Cristiano Toraldo de Francia, who recently passed away in the last couple of years, and he was a member of Super Studio. And again, like, so I'm now living in Florence, Italy.
Yeah.
Like four bridges from the Ponte Vecchio, on the River Arno. And I mean, it was amazing. I went to Moscow Leningrad then. And I was just like, oh my God, where am I? What am I doing? And, you know, I'm Barcelona. It was, again, just my mind keeps expanding. And that's what I still to this day, like anyone who works with us, whether full-time or interns, like I try to encourage as much as possible to experience life, because I mean, it's not only good for your soul as a person, but for architecture, for design, because you're constantly learning about either what's new or just your understanding of like, oh, this is a space that I like, this is a space I don't like, you know, what elements make a space that makes me feel good? And in fact, a lot of our work, we have a lot of European actually clients, but a lot of people say that when they look at our work, it looks European. And when they say that, I think that they mean like that there is sort of there's an understanding of a space, because we work sometimes in limited spaces, being in New York City. But also, I guess maybe the Europeans, modernism or minimalism is much more, used or acceptable, or in comparison to the United States, where maybe traditional architecture, that sort of Pottery Barn-esque kind of vocabulary, is more the norm.
Right.
So yeah. So then, after Italy, like that was my last year, and in fact, I remember giving a lecture at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and I was only on campus for 2 years. I graduated, but I didn't go to graduation, and they changed the rules, so you can no longer be away your last year. You have to be on campus, which means you can only do one extra, curricular off campus option. And I said that was, and it was because of me, because I really only went to on campus for 2 years. But I have to say, I turned out okay.
Yeah, I would say for sure. So how did you get to New York? So you're in Virginia.
So in New York, so this, I will put a slight love connection to this, is that I, Toby and I met at Virginia Tech. He was coming from Oxford Poly. He was in his what they call diploma, which is our graduate level. And we met there and we became boyfriends, and he went back to finish his last year. He went back to finish up something. Yeah, his last year, I went back to finish up my summer quarter. And we wanted a place that we both had been to that we felt was amazing and could be a good place to live. But also we wanted a place neutral from our families, to kind of, honestly, just to be gay. I mean, both of us, at that time, it was scary to us. And this was a kind of a neutral place. And I wanted to work for Richard Meier, so it seemed like a logical place.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a great place to start, to expand all of the experiences that you've had.
Yeah.
Right? And where else better than New York City?
Yeah, and Frank Sinatra said, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. So.
Right. So how did you, did you start at Richard Meier? Is that the...
I did. So my story is, and this is pre-9/11. So like I had my bar mitzvah money that I took out of my savings account or whatever. I got on a red eye. Toby got on his flight. We met, got this little studio apartment. I built a little portfolio in a week. And then we had been to Barcelona a couple of years before, I think, and bought this book, like the 25 New York Architects. And so I knocked on like Stephen Hull's door, Gwathmey Siegel, Richard Meier.
They were all there.
They're all there. So it's like, so I went into Richard Meier's office and Tom Pfeiffer hired me. And that was, again, like a dream come true.
Yeah.
Because I had liked his work from the moment I had discovered it in my undergraduate school. And I actually met him. He was building a house near where I lived. And as a funny story, but I thought this could be a Richard Meier house. My schoolmates were on a field trip visiting Morphosis and a few other places. And I said, you know what, let's just go and check it out. And it was on, a Sunday. And it was all gated up, and this guy came out and said, oh, are you here to see the architect? And I go, sure, we're here to see the architect. And I thought, oh, this would just be like the executive architect, right?
Right.
who shows up? It's Richard Meier. And he introduces himself and says, come on in, take a look around, whatever. So yeah, I've had a few, I think in my mind, a few kind of amazing experiences that have occurred that have been pivotal in my life and my career.
So how did you go from Richard Meier to Masana O'Rourke?
So I was at Richard's for 18 months, and then I went to Columbia Graduate School for a year, the advanced program. So it's three semesters in a row. And believe it or not, after graduation, I didn't really want to be an architect. I was like, oh, there's so many so many things I wanted to do. I thought to go back, like, should I apply to NYU's film school? I want to be a director. And it's like, oh, that is, now that I think about it, it's very cliche, like, to do that. And
seduced by the city.
Well, seduced by the city, but also like thinking, oh, like there's so much more than just architecture. Like architecture can't necessarily say the things I want to say.
Yeah.
I worked at a small interior design firm in the Lower East Side, and then decided I was going to teach. So I went to, I taught at the University of Southwestern Louisiana for a year. And then I came back. I couldn't handle that the Ku Klux Klan were walking about on campus one time.
It's a pretty, pretty big shift from New York City.
Yes, it was a big shift. But again, great experience, great teaching experience, all of that. So I worked for a few firms, smaller firms for a while, and then Peter Marino. And I was there for 6 weeks, and a friend of mine who had worked with me at Richard Meier and Partners, she worked in, she was not an architect or a designer. She was working at the front office. She had become the assistant to the creative director of Donna Karan. And through another friend that we had both worked at Richard Meier, he said, oh, call Brian. Maybe he could help you out. So she said, come on in. We may have some work for you. And I thought to myself, oh, this is like, you know, a little project, some night owl, moonlighting.
Some moonlighting,
yeah. Yeah. So I walked in, and like an hour later, I walked out with an entire store to design in Santiago, Chile. And I went into Peter Marino's office and I quit. That changed the direction of.
Was that the beginning? Was that,
that
the
was
beginning?
The beginning.
Of the
so
firm?
That was Masana O'Rourke, and Toby was working at Ralph Lauren in their store design. He stayed there for a year as we got more work from Donna Karan. And I'm really grateful for Donna Karan. I call it design, but you know, it's they had a, let's say, a box of design elements that you'd arrange. But for me, I was like, it was at that time they were going for their IPO, not at the time, but a little bit after. So they're building up their entire, you know, inventory of stores. So it was go, 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 go. And we were designing their showrooms in New York and Milan. And it was just like a whole new world. Again, very New York, like, you know, this could only happen in New York. So that was our first client. And when that ended, we were freaked out, but it was the best thing ever, because it allowed us to grow and to diversify.
Well, let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, right? But trying to figure out our financials on our own is not one of those things. Luckily, we have FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for business owners like us. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices, to managing online payments, to organizing expenses, and automates them with features like the digital bills and a receipt scanner, saving you up to 11 hours a week in the process. It's also super easy to get up and running, and the award-winning FreshBooks support team they are always available to answer any questions along the way. Compare that to some of the other financial management tools out there. Try FreshBooks for free for 30 days, no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/architect to get started today. That's freshbooks.com/architect. So what will you do with 11 more hours each week? This episode is brought to you by RCAT.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. Listen and subscribe right now at rcat.com/podcast. That's rcat.com/podcast, ARCAT.com/podcast. Detailed, every building has a story. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. When you moved to New York, did you know that you wanted to have your own firm? Was it part of the plan?
So I don't ever have, for some reason, I don't have plans, but I did have, so that was always my plan since I was a kid. I always wanted my own firm. Ever since I went to my dad's first office that he was working at, I thought to myself, so at that office, it was a boutique firm. They did beautiful work. They had this, their own little, not a restaurant, but they had a cook there. And I thought, this is what I want. Like, I'm very family oriented. So for me, it was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to open my own office. It's going to be this small firm that we're all working together and we eat together and we go out together. And so that's,
so you had that vision as a child?
I had that vision as a child.
So it was always part of you. It's like, yes, this is the dream.
Yeah, it was just a matter of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you had that opportunity with Donna Karen, did you see that? Well, you just said that you didn't really go there thinking that it would be the beginning of your firm.
I had no idea.
Came out of the office and said, "Hey, it looks like we're starting a firm."
Well, I mean, when I so because of the scale of the project and the fee that they were giving me, I said, oh, yeah, I literally can just stop working. And let's see how this goes. So, yeah, that was it.
And when was that? How long ago was that?
1996.
Oh, right. That's how I introduced you. 1996.
Yeah.
So it's grown significantly by then. What's the firm look like today?
So the firm looks good. I say that laughingly because, you know, we're not a huge firm, and I have gone through periods of like feeling insecure about our size, and we have been much larger, but I'm now very happy. We're four people, soon to be five, and we've been really good about trying to focus on the work that we want to work on, and making sure that, you know, when you grow in terms of manpower, you have to, as a business owner, you understand like as the machine grows larger, it has a larger appetite,
right?
And you might not always be able to be as discerning, because it, unless you want to fluctuate in size all the time. And I'm Toby and I are not that kind of, we're not built that way. Like, as I said, we're family. So, for us, like we want someone to invest in us and we want to invest in that person. So I'm not interested in like, oh, this could, you could be here 3 months, you could be here a year, you could be here for 10 years. I'm trying to build longevity because security for both of us works better, I think, for both parties.
Yeah. Your portfolio is beautiful. How is that? Was that strategic and intentional that you were going to do that type of work and turn away other types of work? Talk about that a little bit. How do you develop a portfolio that is so, you know, from an architect's point of view, it's the dream portfolio, right? What architects want, right? They want to be able to do that level of design on their projects. And obviously it's also, you're presenting your best work on your portfolio. But Rizzoli also just asked you to do a book, a monograph.
Yes.
And so it's you obviously have a portfolio that is worthy of a monograph. And so was that, when you started the firm, was that strategic? The reason I'm asking is because there's architects that struggle with that. How do I not do the everyday bread and butter stuff and fill my portfolio with that and not have enough time to do the things that I really want to do? How are you, is there sacrifice in order to get to that level? What, share that a little bit about your thoughts on how you got to where you are design-wise.
So I will briefly say that, so the design style really, or the design ethos really comes from, I think, both of our childhoods. Mine specifically, because I'm talking. I used to be, so back to that Scotty's Castle that I visited in Death Valley. So we would go on trips, family trips, about twice a year. And I would be the kind of person who would collect. Do you know when you go to the motel or the hotel, there's that little kiosk with like where you can go horseback riding.
Right, skiing. all the brochures. Yeah.
For some reason, I was just like a pack rat. My room, so there, I grew up, as I said, I think the two younger brothers, all of our rooms were identical. Mine was just full of stuff. And I think it was basically like my second to last or my last year of high school. Like I had this epiphany and I don't know what it was. I constantly try to think about it, but so my room was, each of our bedrooms were themed and mine was Western and I had wood on the walls. I had bunk beds. I had antlers, horseshoes, books, a fish tank. I had everything and from years and years and boxes full of stuff. So yeah. I threw all that stuff out, took all the wood out, painted it white, put in a gray carpet, white, shades, a gray kind of futon that looked like a cartoon of a sofa that would you just pull and it became a bed, and like this red lamp and shelves with some books, and that was it.
What inspired you to do that? Was there some moment in your life that sort of said, I don't want all this stuff anymore, I want to go more minimal?
There was, but I can't,
you don't know what it is.
I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
So I will speak about, for both of us, is that visual noise or distraction is something that we're both acutely aware of. Mm-hmm. So the less for us is the better. It's not for everyone. Not everyone can either live with that. You know, my thing is also like, I'm a horrible consumer. I don't buy a lot of stuff. I like my stuff to last. And I also, probably, I don't know if you can see it, but there's artwork in the back. I have two places for artwork in this apartment, and I have much more artwork than there's walls for, but I switched them out, you know, and I don't need to have everything out all at once. So my idea is, and our idea is really that you kind of heighten and make special things by having less. And also the natural things about space and scale and light for me are ever, light is ever changing. So it's timeless. So those spaces are always, like I said, you know, my house is 20 years old now, and it's not a thing I would change about it. So back to the question, which was, how do we grow a business and not take on every single project? Well, the reality is every architect takes on projects that they don't necessarily, well, there's, I think there's always a point where an architect will takes on work that they might not necessarily want to. And that's because obviously if you're an architect who needs to generate an income to sustain their livelihood, then that's what you do. On the other hand, you may take a project because you really think it's going to be amazing and it could be horrible. But we have over the years, as we, for some reason, I've always wanted to get a book published by Rizzoli. I always wanted to have my artwork acknowledged. I've always wanted to have it photographed. So it's always been the process, right? Yeah. So every time a project is finished, we put money into the photography, and we hire the photographers who are really good and who are also connected, and not necessarily that meaning that our work is automatically going to get published, but they have the eye to make sure that as best as possible, we're capturing that project in a way that is the most appealing to a particular magazine,
yeah,
for example. But, you know, we've had over the years, you know, I think that exponentially the amount of, no one comes to us to design a French colonial, you know, or whatever, right. But in the beginning, I think we had the potential of more of that kind of work, but we were able to, because of our, I guess our overhead was low, and we could, I guess I was going to say the key to really going through that is that keeping your overhead low so that you don't have to,
yeah,
to take on that kind of work. And then what happened is eventually as our work kept getting published and it was seen in one way, you would get less calls out of the blue from someone who wanted a Spanish styled house. And really it became, yeah, you know, 99% of the time, now it's 100%. If they send an email now, because no one calls, it's always email. Right. They understand our work. And in fact, we don't even show our portfolio anymore. I don't even have a portfolio anymore. Our Rizzoli book will be our portfolio.
I was going to say now your Rizzoli book will be your portfolio. Let's talk about that a little bit because we're coming to the end here. Do you have a Rizzoli monograph coming out in October? It's being released. You can pre-order it now. You can see it at MassanaO'Rourke.com. You can pre-order it there as well. Tell me how that happened. Did that phone call just come out of the blue from...
Completely out of the blue. So I have for years have been dying to have a book published and we've had several publishers come to us. But those publishers require you to pay money to have your book published. And I felt very uncomfortable with that. And not because I wouldn't have spent the money, but to me, it felt like, oh, isn't this really just a portfolio that we're designing?
Vanity project
that you're going to, because you have a network, you can distribute it. And it's like, you know, it's like magazines. The magazines you don't pay the magazine to be in the magazine. They decide if your work is of interest, right? So I said, oh, this is not going to work. So, and 3 years ago, an editor had reached out to us and said, oh, you know what, have you ever thought of being in a book? And said, yeah, of course. And he said, well, let's think about it. And that process was taking a while. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, Rizzoli sends me an email saying, oh, we're interested in publishing a book. Would you like to have breakfast? And I said, sure. and I even offered to pay. And they said, oh, no, we've got this. So I was like, that was just happened before COVID. I think it was October before COVID. Yeah. And the book project has taken over 2 years. It's been a long process, much like designing a project, but a little more stressful because so many things. Like it's a real cathartic process of like going through the history of the office and remembering the projects, the people, you know, deciding what gets edited in and what gets edited out. We narrowed it down to 25 projects representing our first 25 years. And it was also a balance between built work and unbuilt work, which we thought was really important. And that was an item that was discussed with Rizzoli and our editor, Mayor Russ, who was actually the first editor to ever publish our work in Interior Design Magazine. So in the end, we thought this is sort of a full circle book. Like we came back to the people that we started with. Tom Pfeiffer was incredibly gracious and is writing the foreword or wrote the foreword. I'm really, you know, we're extremely thankful for everyone who's been involved with our office and made everything possible. Because without them, you know, without the clients, without the, our employees, our collaborators, our consultants, our builders, like it really takes, when you're a small business, you realize like how much effort it takes to get something built. And you know, you wear many, many, many hats. But I am still super excited to wake up in the morning and to see what's next on the horizon or what's going to pop up and either make me incredibly happy or catch me by surprise. Having the book, I feel sort of like I feel like that thing when someone drops the mic at the end, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm done.
But you're not done.
I'm not done. So luckily as an architect, I feel like I won't be done until I am done. And they often say like, I mean, at least when I was a student, like they would say, you know, you're not really hitting your stride until you're 50. So I'm 56 and I feel like we're just beginning.
Yeah. Well, there's some foreshadowing when you described the book. You said it is documenting the first 25 years of the firm, right, which essentially means there's going to be a second 25 years of the firm. And Rizzoli books very often come out with volumes.
Yes. So yeah, I'm so, so happy. I mean, the book was designed by Joseph Logan, and I'm hoping. Again, it was very cathartic. You're nervous about like, oh my God, you know, this is going out now. People are going to see it. What are they going to think? And, but I'm super happy. We're super happy.
Yeah. I mean, understanding and hearing your origin story and all the experiences that you've had, it sounds to me from hearing your story that it was all part of the vision, right? That you had that vision of having that studio, and maybe it wasn't conscious. Maybe it was conscious. But sort of having that dream you had mentioned before we started recording that in architecture school you would, you know, find yourself in the library flipping through Rizzoli monographs.
Yep.
And a lot of us architects have done that, right? I've done that. I've done the same thing, and I've had my collection of Rizzoli monographs, and it was part of the time that you and I went to school. It was, I don't know if it's the same way today, but I know that it was a critical part of our education and our experience. Becoming architects is experiencing and being inspired pre-internet by Rizzoli monographs. And
yes.
So it's really exciting to hear your story, to hear your whole story, and to see how it evolved to where you are today. And I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes in the next 25 years.
Thank you. Thank you. Just my last couple of words is like, I think it's not that I didn't have a plan. So I had goals. I didn't have a plan. I throw something out way in front of me and I figure out how to get to it. So I didn't know how I was going to get a Rizzoli book, or I didn't know how I was going to open up a store. I mean, sorry, an office, but you just make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's a huge power in vision, whether it's written down or not.
I agree.
It's a big part of succeeding. Right, is to look at what your life could be and whether you document it. And I recommend architects document it, write it down so you have something to look at and be your guide.
Yes.
But for those of us who can vision, see that future, and then actively with those, each decision you make, is this leading us towards that vision or not? Yep. And that's how you end up with a portfolio that Rizzoli rings your doorbell.
Right.
That's how it happens, is that you have that vision and you work towards it and you say no to the things that are not part of that vision. It's very intentional whether you write it down or not.
So I agree.
It's exciting to hear your story. And I'm looking forward to seeing where you go next.
Thank you. I do too.
Before we go, I want to ask you the one question that I ask everybody, and it's, sure. and I didn't warn you about this, but it's an easy question. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think key is understanding what you would like to accomplish and being very open and giving in our community in terms of being able to develop a network so that you are part of this architecture design community, so that you are giving assistance and you are taking assistance to better your practice, better design, better someone else's practice. Because I think community is really, really important. And we need, I think as a profession, we need to be much more open about that.
Yeah,
that's what I would think.
I agree. If you're not part of our Entree Architect community, I think you'd fit right in. We have a Facebook group with 8,000 architects in it, private group, and it's focused on architects helping other architects.
All right,
and
great.
So it's entrearchitect.com/group. It'll lead you to a Facebook group that's a private group.
Okay.
And we'd love you to be part of it. So if you're
interested. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
His name is Brian Masana. It's masanaorourke.com is the website. Go check it out. The book information in the book, Building Blocks, is there. It's being released on October 25th, 2022. You can pre-order it right now. So go to masanaorourke.com. It'll be right there on the homepage. And click pre-order. It's beautiful. And you should check out the website as well, masanaorourke.com. Brian, thank you for sharing your story here today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, go write a review. I would love to know what you think of this podcast, and it helps other architects find us. So go do 5-star rating if you like it. Share, write a review. I'd love it. And share a link to this episode with a friend, because that's how we've grown. That's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands of architects throughout the world, just like you. Thank you to our sponsors, RCAT and FreshBooks, for their support of this episode. I ask you to support them because they support us. And if they're supporting us, they're supporting you. So go support them. Got it? Go support our sponsors. Links to our sponsors. So you can click on those links and go right to them. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we shared today are available at the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. All the shows are there. entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows. I think there are 11 of them there now. Go there, gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And I hope you're going to join us in Austin, November 1st through November 3rd, 2022. Those are the dates for the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting, our first ever live and in-person conference for you, the small firm architect community. Visit entrearchitect.com/annual meeting right now to learn more. That's entrearchitect.com/annual meeting, and I will see you in Austin in November. Don't miss this. This is going to be great. entrearchitect.com/annual meeting. It's a conference for you, small firm architects. Thank you for listening today to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
how to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.